Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Diabolik DVD. Check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. They are the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. The company is movie buff owned and operated. Are you looking for rare, unique, and strange films? Then you need to head over to Diabolik DVD. They're constantly updating their inventory and have plenty of movies that you won't find anywhere else. They revamped their website earlier this year, so ordering has never been easier. Some of their latest and upcoming titles include the new Blu-ray of Spasms from Code Red, the amazing new Blu-ray DVD combo of Disconnected from Vinegar Syndrome, the Old Boy 5-disc box set, the all-region media book release of Zetter, and the new Blu-ray of Romero's Season of the Witch from Arrow. They also have all the titles you need from Agfa, Code Red, Scorpion Releasing, Arrow Video, Vinegar Syndrome, and more. The Shockwaves team loves them, so head on over to Diabolik DVD now, www.diabolikdvd.com, or find them on Facebook.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by Shudder. Brought to you by AMC Networks, Shudder is not only a premium streaming video service, but an experience unlike any other. Created for fans of all degrees of thrillers, suspense, and horror, Shudder is home to the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of high-quality, spine-tingling, and provocative films, TV series, and originals, and there's always something new and unexpected for Shudder members to explore. Now available on Shudder are two Dario Argento 80s classics, Tenebrae and Phenomena, now newly remastered in high definition. Widely considered one of the greatest horror directors of all time, Dario Argento has been hugely influential on the Italian thriller genre known as giallo. Shudder is proud to add two of his greatest films to its expanding library. In Tenebrae, an American author becomes embroiled in a search for a serial killer who has been inspired to kill by his new mystery novel. In Phenomena, a girl at a remote Swiss boarding school, Jennifer Connelly in an early role, discovers she has psychic powers that allow her to communicate with insects. She uses them to pursue a serial killer who is butchering young women at the school. Stream Tenebrae and Phenomena and several more Argento films on Shudder today. Shudder is available for $4.99 a month or $49.99 with an annual membership, but our listeners can get a free month by entering promo code SHOCK at checkout. Again, that's SHOCK at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of thrillers, suspense, and horror available to stream anywhere.
Okay, and welcome to episode number 86 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galuzzo, and I'm proud to say that I'm surrounded by the whole gang. El Rickane.
The gang is back in town.
It's been a while, man.
Rebecca McKendry.
What up, guys?
And welcome back, Ryan Turr.
Hello.
No Skype today.
You are Skype
here. Here in person.
Yes. And it was hilarious. Becca's first question was, did you work out the entire time during Halloween? I thought that was hilarious.
I told him, you look like Danzig. No, seriously, like his arms have doubled in size since I last saw him. Ryan, just I'm picturing you on set with just a barbell doing curls.
Did you
do that press? Scene again?
Gotta whip everybody into shape.
Did you bench press Michael Myers? What's going on? It's a scoop on this. Well, welcome back, Ryan.
Thank you.
We miss you, even though you were sort of checking
everybody.
In. Yeah. We missed Kane. You would have gone toe to toe last week.
That's probably the cleanest sign that I'm telling the truth that I was sick, because there's no one. Next to maybe Friedkin, there's no one I'd rather just be in a room having conversations with than Landis.
I think that episode would have been 4 hours.
If
Elric was here.
I think you're probably right.
It was just nuts. Landis talks, I've heard the phrase, he talks from the back of his head, like meaning like there's no filter, it just comes spewing out, and that is it.
And I think it proved to be a great episode. I mean, you guys out there, your listeners, you all loved it. I mean, I think one person said, I'd love to be just sitting on a front porch drinking some lemonade and listening to Landis stories.
In my twilight years.
Yeah, we're right there with you, man.
A Landis Joe Dante podcast. where they're just talking about Hollywood would probably be the greatest thing ever.
Because
they're about the best you could get in a room, and they're buddies. So.
It would never end.
It would be
continuous.
I think Dante would end it. He'd put him in check, but yeah.
I hit all my bullet points. I always wanted to ask him about Hitchcock. I heard that they had a relationship and Tony Perkins and all that. And we got David Bowie, David Cronenberg.
I asked Freeway 2. That was amazing. Freeway 2, people. It was great.
And shout out to Cooper, who I work with here at the office. He did a fantastic job on the episode.
Yes, he did.
Yeah. Long-time listener, first-time caller. All righty. Well, we got a ton of stuff to catch up on. Ryan, why don't you kick us off since you've been
out
of the office.
I'm going to begin with a comic book because Pumpkinhead has resurfaced on the page. Dynamite Comics released Pumpkinhead number one. I read it on the Dark Horse Comics app. That's where I bought it.
Wow.
It's written by Cullen Bunn. It's definitely tonally in line with the Stan Winston film, which is nice to see this franchise get a little bit of respect since the first film, because I feel like it's really been run into the ground. Very distastefully and not with any care as to how Pumpkinhead looked or acted or felt.
That first one just has a great legend.
And the good thing is the comic book features good writing, good atmosphere, and it goes back, it goes deeper into the kind of Pumpkinhead mythology. Here, the start of the comic book, we're kind of delving into the young life of Haggis. When we meet her, she's with a very giant backwoods family, and they're all being assigned a demon. So her demon, they all go running into a pumpkin patch and are all supposed to pick a pumpkin. And presumably, each pumpkin carries some sort of demonic force or whatever, but she finds this one lone pumpkin up on a knotty hill, and it's the Demon of Vengeance pumpkin.
Wow.
But the overall story is about these two cops who are investigating a hit and run. And in their jail cell is actually Bunt from the first film, played by Brian Bremmer. He was the kid, if you recall, from the first film that was leading our 20-somethings around, and he knew the legend. I don't know why he's in jail. I don't know what's going on with his life, but he's basically telling the cops, he's like, oh, no. Some vengeance is going to be doled out tonight, guys. Like, don't bother investigating because you're just going to wind up dead. And the people who are responsible for the hit and run are kind of like these Sons of Anarchy types that live on a heavily armed compound in the backwoods. So the artwork is phenomenal. I thought it was really, really cool. I think his name is Blackie Shepherd is the artist. But you get your first look at Pumpkinhead, and he's drawn just like the movie. So if you're a big fan of the Pumpkinhead comic book, head to your local comic book shop. Dynamite Comics did a really great job with this.
Terrific. And still got some yuppie dirt bikes?
Not yet.
No yuppie dirt bikes.
I mean, the thing is,
nothing says Pumpkinhead.
The story is slightly very familiar, but I'm okay with that if you're injecting a little something new. And I think the Haggis backstory, I don't know where they're going to go with it, but it was refreshing. Yeah.
That's awesome. No, I love when we get these properties kind of in comic book form.
Like, we were talking about Big Trouble and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the Escape from New York one is great. Big Trouble in Little China. I'm reading Back to the Future, not horror. But still, it's like, if we're not going to get these movies anymore, let's get these wild and crazy stories in comic book
form. An easier way for the artist to creatively get that story onto the page as opposed to going through the trenches of Hollywood.
Yeah. Budgets.
Becca, what do you got?
Yes, I will start with, this is kind of a weird one. House of Clocks. Has anyone seen this?
The book?
No. This is the Lucio Fulci movie from 1989.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so Fulci, towards the end of his career, did a series of made-for-TV movies in Italy. So this is 1989. House of Clocks. So it's, you can feel that it's made for TV. Like, it feels kind of safe for Fulci. But that said, it's still, like, gory as fuck. So apparently they have different TV laws there of, like, people still get stabbed in the stomach and bleed out in the middle of the room. But the whole premise of it is that there is this adorable elderly couple. They're just as cute as can be. And they own a clock store. And one night, this group of renegade hoodlums break in and kill them. And then right at that moment, all of the clocks in the store start running in reverse. And so time starts moving backwards, and the couple comes back to life and then spends the rest of the movie trying to kill the horrible teens. And so it's
last
like,
clock on the left.
Yeah, it's literally last house on the left with time travel.
Wow.
The one that, remember when Jackson was on and he was telling us there's a made-for-TV Fulci movie that's like super violent at the beginning?
I think it's a different one because it had like a name like Sweet Sweet Charlie something.
All right, yeah.
I'm
texting.
Sweet Sweet Charlie.
No, it had a different name. It had something okay. like
Sweet House of Horrors. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, Jackson, thank you.
Oh, he texted you back already?
Like, I gotta know.
Sweet House of Horrors. So yeah, but Fulci
I love that he's available.
He's on standby.
He's on standby. You need Fulci advice, I got you covered. No, but I now want to watch the rest of Fulci's made-for-TV films. And yeah, this one too, it was hyper-violent. Like at first I was like, it feels a little more sanitized because it doesn't have quite the sexuality that you see in a lot of Fulci's films. But yeah, then it just kind of, it went off the rails. There were still impalements galore. So House of
That's
Clocks.
That's pretty late for him.
Yeah, my only, the only problem was, I mean, obviously kind of the big like, whoa moment is when the clocks start reversing.
Yeah.
It happens like at the 10-minute mark. And then the rest of the movie is just a straight revenge.
Oh, wow.
So I was kind of like, I wish we could, and there was never an explanation of why the clocks do that. I would have liked a little bit more, but that said, it was a really interesting Fulci selection.
I want
selection.
More exposition in my Fulci film.
You're
I know not the first to ask
I
for that. Ever.
And where did you find The House of Clocks?
This was a blind buy DVD for me. I was literally playing on Amazon one night, and I had queued up Murder Rock because I hadn't seen it in a long time.
Hell yeah.
And I was like, I need to watch Murder Rock. So I queued that up, and then under the you may also like, it said House of Clocks, Fulci. And I was like, well, I've never seen you before, getting you two, and it was like $2.
Did you get around to Murder Rock?
No, I have not. I went for House of Clocks first.
Nice.
I'll get to Murder Rock. I've seen it before, though. Yeah. It's amazing.
All right, The House of Clocks.
Let's stop fucking around. Let's get to it. Hellraiser. Let's talk about it.
Oh, my God.
I
waited 2 weeks to talk about this
Thank
with you.
This is what happened to the listeners out there. I watched Hellraiser Judgment, and I text everybody at the end, and I said, you guys can't talk about this without me. Do not talk about this. This is a group discussion.
All right, I get to be the one that says I didn't bother, so let me hear you guys.
Wait, you didn't bother after I told everyone out there how good it was to watch?
How am I going
to
get... No, it was...
Homework, okay. man.
You know
homework.
What? $20? I'll kick it off.
Like, oh, really? No. You had to pay for it?
Mine was...
Yeah,
really?
Rented. What do you mean?
$5.99 on iTunes.
That's too much. Tell me...
Okay, I will
tell
say...
Tell me it's worth $5.99 right now, all of you.
You are going to really regret this after this conversation.
Right,
before I dig in, I will say that I do feel that this is probably one of the best of them lately, and I kind of...
If compared to the one before, maybe.
Yes, okay.
Short comparison to what?
If we jump from Debtor to this is the last, you know, this is the best out of like,
hold
the
on,
best.
Becca. I'm still sitting, resting,
resting my head.
As soon as
resting
I watched it, the only thing that I said, I texted the guys and I was like, it felt like I was watching a 2-hour long Nine Inch Nails video with Pinhead sitting in a chair just watching
just chilling.
It. Yeah, that's he sat in a chair and watched the Nine Inch Nails
video. Hellraiser, Pinhead takes a nap, or Hellraiser. Hell is really fucking complicated.
Or Hellraiser Naked Gulligers.
Because
there are two naked topless Gulligers in the first
That's
5 minutes.
Two Gulligers for the price of one.
A lot of flesh, John.
I heard it's very Seven. Is this an accurate description as well?
Sure.
It feels very 90s
if
neo.
Seven sucked.
It's neo-gothic 90s punk. Whatever that like leather bondage phase we all went through in the 90s with Trent Reznor, this is living in it.
Yeah, this is, I mean, it basically kind of falls back on the Hellraiser Debtor, Hellraiser Inferno kind of thing, which is, it's mostly a procedural. And it is about these two cops who are following the trail of a serial killer, and he leaves them like little biblical quotes and stuff like that, and you're like, it's Pinhead, and then you're screaming some more going, it's Pinhead. I mean, it winds up being something else, but whatever. But meanwhile, you've got the cop story as your A story, and then you've got Pinhead and his accountant.
They're introduced second. The accountant.
Oh, the cops?
Starts. Yeah,
well,
the cops
that's because,
feel like a secondary
Well, that's
story.
Because I feel like Gary Tunnicliffe, if you guys didn't know, is the writer-director of this episode. And he was the makeup effects artist on many of them.
Mm-hmm.
And a pretty great makeup effects artist in his own right. And he did a Hellraiser short. And I feel like that is the kind of spoke that got placed onto the opening of this film. Mm. So when it opens, you've got this guy who is lured to a house, lured to the house on Ludovico Street. And you've got this kind of hellish accountant who's like, let's talk about your sins. And then he's like typing away on a archaic typewriter. And then once he's got all this guy's sins, by the way, the guy's a child killer. Yeah. And once he gets all the sins poured out, then Gulager comes in and pours children's tears on him to soak them up, and then he eats them.
Yeah.
And then
that's
he vomits
gross.
Into a funnel. The funnel of vomit goes to a bunch of naked chicks on the other side of the wall. They put their hands in it, and then they declare the guy guilty.
It's the naked girls that feel really – that's the kind of part where you're adding that, and it's just like, yeah, guys, this doesn't feel like that's the world.
It's really complicated, man.
Just give them some clothes. I mean, they clearly have a job here. They deserve clothes if they have to put their hands in vomit.
But then they jump to the cop story. But the thing that cracked me up, I don't know if you picked up on this, but when one of the cops winds up going and meeting this accountant, and he's like, oh, your sins are so awful. And I'm like, worse than killing children? Because this guy just talked about all his sins. Yeah. They seem pale in comparison to what that fuckhead in the beginning did. Very weird movie, man. It's and then it gets all super biblical at the end. And
I mean, Pinhead looks better than the last one, which is nice.
Sure.
A small improvement over Fat Pinhead.
I like that they were trying something new with his costume. It had like latex ribs. I don't know how else to describe it. But they kind of redid his costume. It was less bondage-y, but felt more like you bought it at Hot Topic.
Well, he had like a neck brace.
Yeah,
like
it was this very Hot Topic-y kind of Elizabethan, I hurt my neck in a car wreck collar.
I just hate this trend that we've gone with Hellraiser that they're hanging out somewhere. Like they're hanging out in a house. In the movie before that, where they're hanging out in the room
literally
next door.
The adjaining room.
And it's like, where's Pinhead? He's just chilling next door in the other room waiting.
In the den while we work this out.
It's such a bummer because it makes it feel... It really kills the otherworldly specialness of Cenobites who just appear out of we don't know where.
I always loved that they would just appear out of a damn portal in the wall, and then you see this crazy thing, and then Leviathan's like, not yet, my children, come back. And
this is actually a corner for me because I've seen all of them now. I will not watch another one unless it gets like the budget to do a reboot, a real revision of the world rather than another sequel.
Well,
I think
hopefully
I'm
that'll
done.
Happen now.
I mean, I think this cash grab that the Weinsteins kept doing every year, I'm done with it.
Well,
that
there's a bankruptcy thing going on, so the rights will be probably thrown into the ether.
Cool.
I want to read my notes because I think my notes are more amusing than my thing.
I believe it.
Hell feels really complicated. Another serial killer plot? A quote from the film. Did it take a lot of detective work to find out about another detective?
Doing detective work.
Rinse and repeat. Crime scene. Back to office. Crime scene. Back to office. Yeah. Crime scene.
Wow.
Worst detective in the world walks into danger. I never understood drinking and walking. That's not a quote. That's just my own kind of... because
you just came back from the South. That's all they do down there.
You get this detective. He's like, I'm going out for a walk. And then he's just stumbling down the street drinking and walking.
No, that's it. You don't do that. At least.
In Savannah, that's all we did was
Are you serious? Oh, yeah. My mom was always like, she always, and this is such my Southern mom quote, only whores drink and smoke while walking, Becca.
Well, that part's
true,
too.
She used to tell me that.
Yeah, there you go.
She told me that.
Only whores.
And then the last two, incredible detective work, that our female detective texts sneakily about her partner with the cell phone on so he can hear her texting sneakily to someone else about this guy. And then the detective texts, it's Sean, but it's ITS, no apostrophe.
And this is when I tweeted a couple weeks about, please, when you make a movie, don't have a flashback to a Google discovery. And this has that as your climax. The actual climax is a flashback to information you were Googling. It's like, come on. If our language of cinema is that poor, don't make movies. Sorry.
But I will say, I mean, like, you could see what got Gary excited because there's a lot of kind of Hellraiser mythos that he's trying to add new stuff to. And that stuff is kind of interesting. Yeah, and there's like a little battle of heaven and hell. I kind of don't want heaven and angels in my Hellraiser movies.
Yeah.
But you could tell that that's what got him more excited than the actual procedural detective story.
I think now we're at a point with Hellraiser, the way to do it is to make a great A story. And the problem is we keep phoning in our A story and just hoping the Cenobites will do the heavy
lifting.
Yeah. It's like, no, let's let the Cenobites be kind of background and let's make a great story. Mm-hmm. You know, make fucking Call Me By Your Name with Cenobites. You know, make a fucking great movie that just happens to have cinema.
Well, what they forget too, and I think you guys will agree, the great thing about the first Hellraiser is it's a family drama, and it's really about this woman cheating on her, who's thinking about someone else that she loves and is clearly, you know, feeling sexually energized by, as opposed to her own husband. And
she's scarier.
And she's scarier, exactly.
And he's scarier than the Cenobites.
And that's what I think we're missing. It's like, let's go back to the family drama aspect of
it. That's how Dave and I have approached every single one of the comics so far. No, that's how we've approached every single one of the comics is you have the story, you have a villain within the story, and then somehow the Pinhead mythos or the Cenobite. Like, we never went Pinhead. We always created our own Cenobites, but that's how they intertwine.
Well, enough of Hellraiser.
But, well, all that said, it's still unmissable. You should buy it.
Oh, all right. So
and Rob, you got to see it.
A $6 rental. Wow, that
Rob
sounds...
Just because that way you're on the same par as me.
Sure. I do have to... From, like, I'm a diehard Hellraiser fan. I would be amiss if I didn't see it. And I Hellraiser Judgment. They tried really hard. So.
What a review. They tried really
they
hard,
tried
guys.
Really
and it
hard,
it really
guys.
Could say, and it's still better than the last one.
Yes,
we'll give it that.
It is.
Put that on the box.
And
better
it's
than
still
the last
better
one.
Than the last
All
one.
All right. What do you got, Rob?
Wow. Oh, okay. So this is kind of a fun gem that came out of the Shockwaves Horror Movie Club on Facebook, our group there. Basically, I had never even heard of this movie, but it's a French film called Deadly Games, a.k.a. Game Over, a.k.a. 3615 Code Père Noël. And what this was is 1989 French film that basically was a year before Home Alone with a killer Santa that breaks into a home where there's a very resourceful kid that fights back.
Oh, shit.
I'd never heard of it. But what happened is there's this great German three-disc Blu-ray. And Diabolik DVD had posted about it, so we're on brand because they're our sponsor this
week. Sponsored by Diabolik DVD.
They had posted, and I don't know why it was cryptic, but basically they posted, hey, we have a couple of copies. We will not be able to sell this anymore, so this is it. And of course, when I hear completely limited, cannot get it anymore, and I've never heard of it, I went for it right away. And so I picked it up. A lot of the people in the group were actually recommending it, and that's where I found the link. And I just watched it this weekend. I had AJ Bowen over, because
Christmas horror fanatic.
He is a Christmas horror fanatic, and he had never heard of this either. So I was like, "Oh, you got to come and check this out."
He's got to come next Christmas. We got to get him back for a Christmas.
Josh Miller, who hosted Friday Night Frights and has been on our show as well. So we got a nice little group together when we watched it. This movie is actually like a really solid gem. I was really blown away by this thing, and it started almost kind of goofy because so it's this little kid who's kind of like a genius with like electronics. Like, he's kind of like a little Tony Stark. And there's even a montage at the beginning. He's obsessed with Rambo. And so there's this terrible knockoff of Eye of the Tiger playing. Like, literally, it's like, din, din, din.
One key off.
Yeah, while he's like kind of like running through the house with his dog, like trying to capture his dog and setting up traps for him and stuff. And you're like, what the hell is this? But what happens is simultaneously there's this really creepy French guy who in the opening scene is trying to there's a bunch of kids on the street having a snowball fight, and he just like runs in the middle of it and tries to get in it, and it's so awkward and creepy, and you're like, okay, that guy's not right. Whoever that actor is, they find the perfect guy. And so then he ends up becoming like a department store Santa, and actually one of the scenes that really knocked my socks off is a little girl on his lap says something like, I don't like your face. And he just like slaps her. And you're like, oh shit, there's like child violence in this. Wow. And so anyway, he gets fired from the job, but he's still in his Santa outfit. And he overhears that this little kid, through the stepdad who works at the department store, that this kid is going to be home alone just with his grandpa.
Yeah.
And I don't know why he just decides, I'm going to stalk this kid. And so he goes and breaks into the house. And I mean, from there, it's kind of – there's one dark thing that will might lose you. And I don't know if I should even tell it because it's kind of a spoiler.
Yeah, don't say.
But there's one thing that's really taboo that happens immediately when he breaks into the house.
Oh, shit.
And that's when you're like – that's when you just stop laughing.
You know you're
like, off-kilter. Oh, shit.
Yeah,
okay, this is going to be weird. And then it's fun. Then he's basically like chasing this kid around the house, and the kid, I don't even want to say he sets up traps, but it is definitely kind of a mouse, cat and mouse sort of deal with them. But what was, you know, again, I'd never seen it. This Blu-ray looked spectacular. I had a region free player, and I looked up the filmmaker. It's written and directed by a guy named René Manzor. This was his second film, and it was funny. Josh Miller was just like, So did he do anything we know, or did he, or is this a guy that made like seven amazing French films we're about to discover?
Right.
And I'm like, I think he made seven amazing French films because I don't know his other work, but there was a great interview with him on the disc. And, you know, usually we skim through features just to see what they're like. But we were kind of mesmerized by his story because he was super young when he did his first movie. He went right into this one, and it's unlike anything. And it's just like, it's rare that you get that feeling where you see something like, how have I never seen this? How is this not a cult hit already?
Yeah.
I guess it's the availability factor from, you know, Bahir. But so the disc I found, it's called Deadly Games, the disc that I have, and it was a German import. I think you get it on like Amazon overseas.
Okay.
If you want,
did he make any other horror films?
I don't know about other horror films.
The last name sounds familiar, Manso.
Yeah, I looked it up. What was his first film was called The Passage. Yeah. And then, well, it says he's uncredited on a Highlander movie. That's kind of interesting. Highlander, The Final Dimension, uncredited though. So I wonder if, you know, maybe that was his one American movie or attempt at it. But no, I thought this was really kind of exceptional and a fun gem. And it was hilarious because I think Josh is like, well, I guess I'm going to screen this hopefully come December.
Awesome.
He's like, I'll probably be borrowing your Blu-ray, Rob. So,
nice.
You know. So yeah, Deadly Games, a.k.a. Game Over, a.k.a. 3615.
Wow.
Wow.
Very cool one, yeah. Ryan?
I there's some really great discoveries that I made over the weekend. I'll start. I went to a VHS swap over the weekend.
Oh, yeah.
And I picked up a film called Spare Parts. In German,
is
it's
this
called
Fleisch.
Fleisch. Mm-hmm. 1979, directed by Rainer Erler. The cover is kind of like maroon, and on the front box cover, it's got like a girl like just kind of chopped up. But, you know, it's cleanly done. It's not super gory.
That's on your VHS?
Huh?
That's on the VHS cover?
Yeah.
I have the same VHS, but mine is a, girl,
it's like a
running
girl running
from the truck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. I have a big clamshell now. I went in with no expectations. I'd never heard of this film before. But what I got was something like surprisingly enjoyable and mysterious. And then it waterfalls into something that's sluggish and a little heartfelt. Yeah, Rob's pulling it up right now.
I'd buy that box.
Yeah, that's
sure.
A great box.
Yeah, yeah, see the one over there where it's the girl from the truck is what's on my VHS.
Yeah.
Or it's an ambulance, yeah.
But it's a German film, shot in the U.S., dubbed, charmingly so. There's some really, really great stuff. But basically what you have is a film about a musician and his new bride who are in New Mexico, and they honeymoon at this kind of really quaint Valentine-themed motel, and they meet this really sweet old woman. And while they're just kind of hanging out in the back of the motel, walking through a field and just enjoying Mother Earth, this ambulance just starts trucking towards them. And they obviously panic. The husband walks over and he's like, yo, what's up? And they knock him out. The ambulance drivers knock him out. They throw him in the back of the ambulance. They go after her. She flees. She escapes them. And then she gets picked up by the nicest trucker in the United States of America, who instantly wants to know her story. She tells it. He doesn't believe her at first, but then he kind of comes around to her side of the story and is like, I got to help you. And so he's like, I'm going to find your husband. We're going to find this ambulance and we're going to fuck him up. And so he relies on his network of truckers the U.S. of A.
Convoy. Awesome.
To track down this ambulance. And what they do is they put both her and him, they both get they get into costume. She puts on a wig. She's a blonde girl. She gets into a wig and they go back to the motel. And they basically act as bait. And sure enough, that ambulance comes and tries to get them. And then you have a great scene of a bunch of truckers like, Big Bear, Big Bear, we see the ambulance coming down the road. Let's go get them. And then you just see like all these trucks trying to like basically herd the ambulance into a trap. They get these guys. And you discover the entire thing is an organ harvesting plot.
Yeah, a little bit of the ambulance.
I knew
in there.
It wasn't a clever title. That's great. Spare parts. I got it.
So it's at that point where things start to kind of trickle into sluggish narrative.
Yeah.
They discover where everybody's going. They discover who's behind the operation. And you know, there's a little bit of detective work done, but the pacing really slows down. But it takes them from New Mexico to New York City. The movie film ends in New York, and then it kind of has a nice little happy bow on the end. But
what year is that? Is that before
79.
The ambulance?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, so it's before the ambulance.
Yeah, but really interesting. I mean, like,
it's a
fun film. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of like just in between. It's not great. It's not terrible.
Yeah.
But it's certainly enjoyable to watch, and we were captivated the whole time. We were like, oh, what's going on behind
for
this?
For a blind by VHS. That's all you're looking
VHS.
For.
Yeah, it was fantastic. Nice. So, Spare Parts, 1979.
So I watched Tigers Are Not Afraid.
Oh, well, you have to watch that one. We're all kind of behind on that. No spoilers then.
No spoilers. I'll just give you the setup and that's it. So we were given screeners of this one, and it took me a while to get to it, but I'd heard a lot about it. It had a lot of festival buzz.
It won Screamfest.
It won Screamfest. It won a couple of fests.
I gotta watch it.
So the setup, it's a Mexican horror film directed by a female Issa Lopez. I'm probably saying that name wrong, but Issa Lopez. And she, you mentioned, you know, having somebody who's made like 7 films in their home country, and then we just discover one. She's made like 10 plus films in Mexico, a lot of them more comedies. And this looked like it was her first horror film. The setup is that it's set in this small Mexican village that is just plagued by drug cartels. And slowly, all of the adults are being killed off. They disappear. They talk about how it's becoming like a ghost town, just leaving the kids behind because the adults keep disappearing. Either they see something or they're there when something else goes down. And so it's this group of kids whose parents have all been killed by the cartel. Kind of bond together, and they're homeless, so they're living on the roofs of like shelled out empty buildings. And one of them starts kind of experiencing this ghost. And the ghost is telling her to do things. And the cartel is chasing them the whole time because the cartel thinks that they may have seen something and that one of them stole a cell phone from the cartel. And there's some incriminating stuff on the cell phone. And so the cartel's chasing them. But then these ghosts come into play.
Oh, that's it.
That's it.
Enough.
That's where I'm stopping.
That's enough. Got to watch it.
The movie, it's heavy. Like, I cried at least 3 times.
Oh, cool.
Your main protagonists are 5 kids. They carry the entire movie. You literally, the cartel is just like your D-plot. It just barely comes in and out, and then it comes and becomes kind of more important as the film moves along. But for the most part, you're just following these 5 kids and kind of what they're going through in this absolutely fucking bleak-ass environment. Yeah, I bawled my eyes out.
There's
a
lot of poetry
times.
To it. I saw it as well. I mean, I wasn't as enamored by it because it just kind of flat-out bummed me out. But it's a quite a beautiful character.
It's gorgeous. Yeah. There's a lot with graffiti because since it's just this shell of a city left, the kids all paint graffiti on the wall. So it's all of this beautiful graffiti and artwork that kind of talks about what they're going through, and the pictures tell the story along with the story. And so the artwork intertwines, and it's visually haunting and beautiful because you're just looking at these shells of buildings. It just made me suddenly go, well, fuck, my life isn't that bad. It's heavy. But
cool.
Yeah, it's really good. It'll
Yeah, I meant to watch it before this one. I totally forgot that we had that. So
yeah, I highly recommend it. I looked it up to see if they had anything about U.S. distro yet. And they at this point, nothing has been announced. But I'm hoping it will soon because that's something that I think a lot of people will enjoy. It's very heavy. It's not a straightforward horror film. It's not like you're going to get ghosts in the first frame and then have them through the whole thing. They kind of seep in and then become prominent as the movie plays out. But yeah, it's
good
great.
Horror.
Yeah. It's good horror.
Holy shit, guys. By next weekend, Get Out could have an Oscar. Isn't that wild?
Don't jinx us.
Dude.
I've already put all my chips on for no matter
is
what,
it
original
Sunday?
Screenplay.
It's this Sunday, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
I just did my Oscar pool at work, and I did original screenplay, and I took a big risk and did Best Picture, even though I knew it's an outsider, but I have a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I'm saying, not to jinx anything.
I'm very proud of Bea, who is the executive on that one, along with Cooper, and she's currently on our other production, Ma, with Tay Taylor, and she's coming out right just for the Oscars.
So awesome.
Super proud.
She gets to go, I'm assuming.
She's going. No. She's coming. She's flying back from Mississippi just for the Oscars, and then she's flying back out. And I'm just so proud of her.
There's a really good episode of the Leonard Maltin podcast. The latest episode is with Jordan, and it's really interesting because there's stuff I haven't heard him talk about before on there, and it's just a different kind of view. It's pretty cool that Leonard Maltin's a big fan. Also, Leonard Maltin thought Get Out was easily the best film of the year, so that was pretty cool. That's a pretty good endorsement. have when you're a film nerd, like Jordan Peele is. Anyway, so check that out if you're into it. I saw a movie that I know Ryan is a fan of. I saw it last night, Veronica, the new Netflix original Paco Plaza, I love the Wreck films. I thought this was really good. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a really solid movie.
Super solid, scary movie.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with it. There's a couple times where you go, oh, it's just shy gear, mm-hmm. but that doesn't matter. That doesn't spoil the experience. It's really interesting. It's like schoolgirl, early 90s? A bunch of schoolgirls in Spain. This one girl's basically set up to be like the mother of her siblings because her mom, who is one of my favorite child performers of all time, Spirit of the Beehive, was the little girl in that movie, is in this. And I recognized her straight away, and it kind of freaked me out because I haven't seen her in 30 years. So this girl's kind of like looks after her siblings. She's probably like 14, 15, and she and her friends on the day of this solar eclipse, which kind of reminded me of Penumbra. Mm-hmm. All the kids are going upstairs to look at the solar eclipse, and her two friends go downstairs of this Catholic school to do a seance, an Ouija board, and she wants to kind of connect to her father who's died. And so it has a lot of heart from frame one. You really, you know, always the problem with movies like this is if you don't give a shit about the character, like if you don't care if they live or die, and from frame one, you really, because she cares about her siblings so much and she's the caregiver, you instantly care for her.
Yeah.
And I thought that was super effective. Yeah. And then basically from there, she opens something in the dark. It's like almost, I know it ties in a bit to what we're doing today at Channel Zero, but the thing that she unleashes kind of reminded me a little bit of Channel Zero first season kind of creature.
And
it's super, super well done, minimal in the way that spooky things should be. It doesn't give you too much of the monster. It's a quiet thing that's kind of stalking you and walking around looking creepy. And I think where it goes, you know, it becomes a possession type of story with this girl and her siblings. But it's never boring, and it's always moving, and it's super creative with the visuals.
There's nuns. I'm looking at it.
Nuns.
I had not heard of this.
Ticks your blind nun box.
Have you seen this yet, Rob?
No, I haven't. I heard a lot about it because I know it's come out overseas, and it literally just popped up on Netflix.
That's like overnight.
Is this from Spain or Mexico?
It's the Paco Plaza guy.
But it's really good. I think people will be a nice surprise.
You guys should check it out because I feel the combined forces, I think this is our next Shockwaves approved.
Okay. I will watch this tonight.
Veronica.
No, I had good fun with it.
Great. I'm in line with our sponsors yet again because my next pick is Dario Argento's The Cat of Nine Tails. Limited edition Arrow release came out on Blu-ray, and I pre-ordered it from Diabolik DVD. When it comes to Arrow...
Sponsored by Diabolik DVD.
Yes. When it comes to the Arrow stuff, I do not hesitate to buy it from them. And the reason being is because the first pressing is always kind of this limited edition thing. It comes with like a booklet or a pin or whatever the case is. I bought basket case from them too. And you can order it from Amazon, but then the day it gets released, Amazon magically gives you a, hey, this is back ordered. Yeah. And you're like, what? And so I just don't, when it comes to these things, I don't play around. I ordered from Diabolik.
Well, I was going to say, Diabolik saved my ass because Amazon, I had to order through Amazon UK, the Carrie Special Edition, the nice box set.
And
then they told me, oops, sorry, we're sold out. We don't have it. And then Diabolik sent out a newsletter.
Sponsored by Diabolik DVD.
We genuinely love them.
But they were super quick. They were like, hey, we got this set. We got the carry boxes. And I was like, oh, God, thank you. So...
Yeah, no, they're great. I mean, and this set sold out by the time it was released. Mm. And even Diabolik said, we're sorry, unless you pre-ordered it, that's the only way you're going to get this limited edition set. It's great. It's actually one of the earlier, now I'm kind of like filling in my Argento blind spots, and it's one I hadn't seen, actually. I'd never seen The Cat of Nine Tails.
It's movie number two, right?
Yes. Yeah. The first one was Bird with a Crystal Plumage, this is two, and then
and this one's
flies.
Really funny, like good dialogue.
This one, you know, it's funny because I went into it, most people, even Dario doesn't consider it one of his better ones. Yeah. For whatever reason, but I remember you, Elric, talking, I think after you had seen the marathon, that you how strong of a writer he was for those first few films.
Yeah, especially the dialogue.
And that's that's the thing. This is like a two-hour movie. It's just about 2 hours, which normally I'm like, it's more than 90 minutes. But it's sharp. It's really well written. And basically, there's a blind man with the equivalent of a daughter right at the beginning who kind of overhears some shady business happening. Mm-hmm. And then a murder happens kind of in his area, and he kind of teams up with a reporter. And so the two of them have this great kind of rapport as they're trying to figure out exactly what's going on. And there's some great sequences. I mean, random people are getting killed. So, like, there's one guy, for example, who gets kind of pushed in front of a train, and that's like trademark Argento. Like, when you see that,
the guy being trapped in the mausoleum is a great sequence.
Oh, yeah, really that fun. Whole scene. There's a whole great sequence there.
And it's Carl Malden as the blind guy, and he's a great actor.
Yeah. And so I loved it. I thought it had all the trademarks of, like, great Argento in terms of, like, just style. It's funny. I mean, the love scene I thought was absolutely hilarious. It's, like, my favorite Argento love scene now. It's, like, the way that it kind of transpires. And then there's this whole thing about milk, which you're just like, oh, my God, is that – okay.
Is there a lot of lip mashing in the love scene? I mean, like, I
have
love –
have you seen it, or do you remember?
I saw it, like – 15, 20 years ago.
Okay, you need to watch this new Blue. No, it's just, so it's actually, what's fun about it, and I've been watching a lot of Hitchcock this week too, and I understand now the whole argument with him is because before this love scene starts, he is picking up two, like, paper things of milk, one of which has been poisoned, which we, the audience, know. Yeah. And so this milk thing is kind of in the background during this whole love scene.
Oh, and they're weird paper things, right?
They're the weird paper things. One is leaking because obviously somebody put the poison in it. But you know, I can't remember exactly what it was. It's just the exchange where she shows up in the middle and he's like, it's funny you coming at this hour of night. And she's like, well, you know what that means, coming at this hour of night.
Netflix and chill.
The way he, like, said it, where it became a love scene, is like, oh, that was pretty smooth. Nice. Way to go, Argento. And then it becomes a, I don't have anything but milk. Do you want to drink the milk? And so all of a sudden, it's a suspense scene. Yeah. You know, but it's great. It's so much fun. And the ending is kind of weird and abrupt, but it's really good. And I like this disc a lot. There's a brand new interview with Dario on it, which is kind of neat. And, you know, he likes the film, but it's not one of his favorites of his early. He thought for whatever reason he could have done it better. And I'm like, I don't know what he's talking about. This is no Dracula 3D, but come on.
Yeah, it's definitely less visual than some of the other. But that's why, I mean, you see his writing more, which was nice. You
know? Yeah, and then, I mean, he goes to Four Flies, which is totally visual right off the bat. Yeah. So that's on there. And there's an interesting, I guess there was a lost ending that they shot that wasn't, but the footage is lost, and so they do a cool thing where they found the pages of the script and kind of recreate it. Like, you see the pages read the ending while you see screen grabs and stuff. And I was like, oh, that's a neat special feature too. And so just from top to bottom is a great set. I think the only thing you'll be missing now if you don't get this limited edition is the booklet and poster that comes with it, which, you know, it's a bummer, but I think the disc itself is worth it. So Cat of Nine Tails, Dario Argento.
Yeah, it's
firing on all cylinders.
I love having all those boxes side by side.
They're beautiful, right?
They're really nice. I will close out. First off, have any of you guys seen Annihilation?
No. Because
this is worthy of a group discussion.
Yeah, let's hold out because I was trying to see
it this
week.
And to those who did not go see Annihilation over the weekend, please do so. Top 10 for me.
Wow.
Immediately. It's so
well,
so
I mean,
great.
Look, Ex Machina's brilliant. Yeah. So, like, why would the follow-up?
Well, you know,
yeah,
this is
Ex,
like,
Machina
this
was
is
in,
like,
all of our
Alex
top 10s
Garland on Lovecraft.
And people
juice.
Tell me Stalkerish.
Which, yeah, I've heard that made me really
excited. Yeah, which is perfect
excited.
Timing for it. Yeah. So this is,
I'm going to close out with Video Violence from 1987, written and directed by former video store clerk Gary P. Cohen. It's available on Shudder, which was a nice discovery.
Yeah.
But man, this thing is like bonkers. Yeah. It's basically about a video store clerk who used to be a former movie theater owner, but he moved to the suburbs to, you know, engage in those conversations with, you know, fellow movie nerds. And one day someone slips into their return pile a blank, you know, on the surface it's a blank tape. He pops it in and it's a snuff movie.
Yeah.
And it's these two locals who are killing people. And there's some sort of homicidal rage virus thing going on if you watch this thing. So he discovers that everybody in his town is killing people on camera. But they have the instinct to just return it to him at the video store so other people find it. So you've got like a mother walking in with her newborn. She's like, just scouring the horror section. And then she's like, hey, does this have any sex in it? And the guy's like, no, it's got a lot of violence though. And she's like, that'll do. And then she like rents it and takes it out. But it's like super lo-fi, DIY, you know, looks like crap. I mean, it's the best quality looking crap on Shudder. It's on Shudder,
No, was the movie SOV?
Shot on video.
Oh, shot on video. Yes. Shot on, Becca, speak English.
God damn it. Know the terms, right?
It was shot on.
For a guy that has a thing called slashback video, you should know.
I know. She took me on the
Yeah.
But it's got a very, very, very New England vibe to it. It's, you know, when the blood flies, it's very red. There's some unpleasant moments here and there because you're following these two killers just preying on women. So there's like these kind of prolonged scenes of just women being tortured and killed. But you kind of have a good time following the video store clerk with his little ponytail.
It's a pretty grisly little movie. Yeah. Quick shout out, because you said SOV, Brad Henderson and Mike D. Splatt have started a podcast. I think they're 3 episodes in, and they're going to cover every single SOV film in order. So it's called the SOV Cast.
Heroes.
They're going to be changed from this experience. Oh, yeah. So just shout out, check them out. I'm sure all of us will be on it at some point talking about some nasty piece of work.
But. Oh my gosh, that sounds nuts. I'll do, I have 3 quick things to discuss. So I watched The Lodgers, which is coming out soon from Epic.
It's out now officially, and thank you for mentioning that.
No problem. Lodgers, out now. I checked. Izzy said I could talk about it. I was like, there's no embargo, right? She said, go. So The Lodgers, this is an Irish horror film, which is coming out through Epic Pictures.
It is already out.
Thank you. It is set in the 1920s, kind of post-war. And in the movie, there's still a lot of tension going on between the Irish and the Irish characters and England. That kind of weaves in and out of the story. The whole thing is pretty much about 2 kids. Well, they're 18. It's a brother and a sister, twin brother and sister, who live in this ginormous gothic mansion at the edge of town. And they've lived there their entire lives. They are completely secluded, shut-ins. She goes to town occasionally to get supplies, but they don't talk to anybody, ostracized. And then gradually you find out what their family's secrets are, what is haunting them. They keep talking about how they have to follow these rules. Like right from the top of the movie, you find out about these rules that they have to follow at the house, where like you have to be in bed by this time and you have to shut your door and you can't go here. And you find out what they mean and kind of what the family history is. It was great. It's got a lot of, I've talked before about how the one book I've always wanted to make into a movie is this Shirley Jackson book called We've Always Lived in the Castle.
Yeah.
It's got a
the one that Mike Flanagan's doing now?
No, that's Haunting of Hill House.
Oh, that's right.
No one's touched We Have Always Lived in the Castle yet. Saving it for me, guys. Nice. But this has the same type of vibe where it's like, or very much kind of like a Vincent Price Poe-ish thing where it's like the weirdo people at the edge of the village in the giant castle. And it is a true gothic horror where the house is breaking down with their psyches.
There's some amazing visual sequences of the house, kind of what's coming. You know, we won't ruin that for you, but there's some amazing photography, doing things in reverse. Yeah. I mean, it's a really good, solid film. It's by the guy who made Let Us Pray, which I also really like.
Who I think we're having...
No, not yet.
Okay, never mind.
Maybe when he's in town, we'll
pretend
try.
I didn't say that. But yeah, Brian O'Malley, who did Let Us Pray. So yeah, it's totally gothic. So I really enjoyed that one.
Yeah, it's a classic film.
I watched Scalpel.
Yeah, I'm dying to see that. I'm curious about that one.
It's
from Arrow, the other Arrow.
Yeah, the other Arrow.
I haven't heard of it before.
I hadn't heard of it before either. This is from John Krasmer, the guy who did Blood Rage, which means Elric would probably like it. I struggle to call it a horror film. The beginning feels like a horror because it's about a plastic surgeon, and it opens with him and all these other plastic surgeons kind of sitting around swinging dicks is the only way I can talk about it. Like, isn't it awesome to be plastic surgeons? We are so badass. We make so much money. I mean, literally, that's like the course of the discussion. And then he goes into surgery to do some plastic surgery. And then it becomes like a show on the medical channel where you're actually watching like them remove skin. And at one point, this guy holds this thing up and is like, well, I'm holding her chin. And it's just like, it's total exploitation. Huh. And then it moves into his life. So we kind of get that gory opening. And then what it is, his daughter is set to inherit all this money. But she's estranged and she completely disappeared a couple of years ago and no one knows what happened to her. And the old guy that she's inheriting all the money from has just kicked it. And the father decides to take another woman who has no family, no background, anything, reshape her face so that she looks like his daughter, and then have her claim the money. So he trains her on, because she's like, you know, urchin from the street. It feels very kind of Pygmalion.
More noir, isn't it?
Yeah, it feels really Pygmalion that. And so he like trains her how to, you know, act like she's upper crusty, teaches her everything about the family, and she goes in and claims the money. This all happens in like the first 10 minutes of the movie. Then it gets weird because he starts having a very sexual relationship with this girl who looks exactly like his daughter. But then it gets even weirder, and it keeps getting weirder. And it just is kind of there's not so much horror aside from the first 5 minutes of Surgery.
Would it fit into the book on your in front of you called Strange Cinema?
It would totally fit into this. It's very much like a modern day Oedipus, because he starts kind of banging the daughter lookalike, and it's got a lot of Pygmalion, and it's just kind of a twisted drama. But it was still, it was a good movie. I was entertained the
Oedipus
whole time.
Oedipus bangs his mom.
I know. I'm aware. Thank you.
There needs to be a different term for the flip. I don't know.
It's all incest.
Oedipus doesn't go both ways.
There's something else going
on. So it's not exactly horror, but still it was a fascinating watch. And then I will close by talking about this awesome book that was sent to me by listener Michael Vaughn.
Wasn't it sent to us collectively, or was it sent to you?
This came to my house.
Oh, okay. Thanks, so, Michael Vaughn.
Actually, I think it may have come to the Blumhouse
office. Yeah, thanks for nothing.
So
thanks,
maybe Michael Vaughn. Share. I'll pass around to you guys. This reminded me of when I was in high school, I read those Video Hound books, like novels. Like
I was Psychotronic Movie Guide, all those things.
And I would literally put post-it notes on the pages of the movies I had not seen and then try to hunt them down. And I found myself doing the exact same thing with this. It functions in the same way where the movies are broken up into these very broad genres like crime, action, horror, just plain weird stuff. And then it's just kind of an alphabetical listing with descriptors and, you know, kind of the general history of the movie. I've already discovered like 10 to 20 titles in here that I've never even heard of before. It has all the standbys that you think would be in a book like this. Like there's a lot of kind of Nick Zeddy, Geek Maggot, Bingo, like weird underground stuff. But then there's some things that I'm like, well, I have to find this now. So it's just, it's a tome, like I mentioned.
But it's good. The illustrations are actually really clean, photographic.
Yeah,
it's not cheap looking like a lot of these books can be.
It does not feel cheap at all. And I've had it on my,
copy.
Yeah, I will totally pass this to you.
And I want it.
We will get you a copy, Kane. But yeah, I've had it sitting on my coffee table, and I've totally just been flipping through it whenever I have 5 minutes while I argue with my daughter about why she has to put her shoes on if we're going outside. I'll sit down and start reading this until she comes to her senses and puts her damn shoes on. It's really good.
The Ultimate Guide to Strange Cinema.
Yes, The All Ultimate right. Guide to Strange Cinema by Michael Vaughn.
Just in conclusion, the last one, it's kind of video violence-y. I had never seen, it's true. I hadn't seen this one. I had seen the cover for years from Code Red had it, but it's on Amazon Prime right now called The Dead Pit.
Oh, yeah.
Brett Leonard, the auteur behind Lawnmower Man. This movie...
What are you laughing at?
Yeah. Ryan's like running out of the room.
Auteur behind Lawnmower Man.
You know, this movie's, look, it's better than the new Hellraiser. But it definitely has that feeling.
Is that our litmus test
cover.
For everything?
It's got an amazing cover.
Didn't it light up?
That was why it's famous on VHS. It had lit up. It's got moments where it's in kind of zombie mode towards the end, where it actually is pretty awesome, but it's also got it's really definitely a cult type movie, because there are moments where like it's like a doctor at the start, and very instantly you find out this doctor has been operating on the mental patients in the basement. They go down at the basement of a mental asylum, and it looks like, you know, a 17th century lair. All of a sudden you're like, what the fuck? And then of course he's like, yes, I've been doing these operations, and he's got a pit full of dead patients. And then of course he gets shot in the head in the first couple minutes, this doctor, and the wall gets sealed up to pretend like nothing ever happened, and then cut to, you know, 40 years later or whatever, and this woman patient's being very mysterious. You don't really know her backstory. She's being taken into this new madhouse, as it kind of is portrayed in this, and on her first day there's a big earthquake, which puts a crack in the wall for where the things were, and slowly the story unfolds where the doctor is going to come back from the dead and continue his depraved work. But there's a couple cool moments where kind of the zombies are coming to life and things are happening, but there's also a lot of moments in between that where it's just, you know, on a character level, it's just not that engaging. I was pretty sick when I was watching it, so I was a little tired, but it was one of those films that doesn't really grab you from start to end, but the start and end are both pretty entertaining. But I can see this film, I can see why this would have a cult, and I bet you there's people who love this movie, even though for me, there's something about Brett Leonard's direction that is just a little standard in my mind. But, you know, it's all right. I'm glad I finally got to see it.
Now, let me ask you, how did Dead Pit look? on Amazon Prime.
On Amazon Prime, it looked okay. It didn't look like, I wasn't like, whoa. So I don't know what I was seeing.
Yeah, because there's a bunch of like the Vinegar Syndrome stuff. It looks like Bloodbeat and Demon Wind is on Amazon Prime. But the thing is like,
yeah, I don't watch it like
if
that.
If it's not good looking, I can't watch it that way. Like I need the Blu-ray version, if anything.
Of those films, I think it's worth holding out for, yeah.
Okay.
All right, I've seen some stuff on Amazon Prime that I'm like, this looks way better than any
I think often it
I've
is
seen.
The HD versions. I think often when it's something like, not necessarily Code Red, but anything like from Severin.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
they're getting good versions on there, yeah.
Yeah. yeah. I just wanted to close out with, I would give a little love to Scream Factory, who we haven't talked about in a little bit. They just put out two pretty stellar discs of two films that have already been out on Blu-ray. And so I think it's worth it to talk because now these are new collector's editions. But they did a new edition of The Strangers and they did a new edition of Drag Me to Hell. Mm-hmm. And so I went straight for the new features because obviously I know they're going to look great. Strangers is, I mean, I'm kind of excited for the new movie. I like this film, but I've only seen it like once when it came out.
Oh, really?
And the reason being is because it really messed me up that I just never felt like there's no Friday night that I'm like, I'm going to watch that really unpleasant Strangers movies again and have a good time.
I do that.
It's a great movie, yeah. but I, you know,
you
it's
like
the same,
a bad time.
It's
right?
Same with like Last House on the Left. I can't put that on a Friday night.
I totally, it's like weekend viewing.
Although I watched Deliverance last night. I was Tuesday is what you do unpleasant.
That's Deliverance night.
That's Deliverance night.
I think The Strangers is one of those contemporary horror films that I find myself reaching for more often than anything else. I was actually thinking, being very reflective on. I've been very
dark.
Reflective on these kind of these modern horror films, and I'm going, boy, I haven't watched that since opening night. I wonder why, or I haven't seen that since it came out 5 years ago. Like, Let the Right One In. I've seen it once.
I'm trying
to get to the root of why I don't go back to those as much as I do, you know, the 90s, 80s, 70s, 60s, and so on. So I'm trying to be a little bit more.
But you love like Let the Right One
yeah.
In.
Yeah,
right? I do.
See,
I do. But I just don't know why I don't reach for it.
I head back to Drag Me to Hell every couple of, yeah. I'd say like yeah. every few months. It's like a pair of comfy pajamas.
Well, deep
me.
Down, it's like, I've had this conversation with Darren Lynn Bousman, who's a guest on Mixed Show this week, by the way. But he says like some of his because I wanted to tie it into Mixed Show by the way but he said something that stuck with me. He's like, there's certain movies that are so good, your experience of it, that you almost don't want to go back and revisit taint that thing. Let the Right One In is one of those types of movies, although I can watch that whenever.
Also, I feel like movies that feel almost perfect, you have less desire to rewatch them because the experience of them is kind of a little bit overwhelming and it becomes great art, and great art isn't actually something you rewatch. Yeah.
Well, that's a little bit what I'm getting
weirdly
at.
Enough,
you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Black Christmas, Rosemary's Baby, The Omen, The Thing. Those are five films that I watch at least once a year. I'm not, I know them. I'm obsessed by them. I've hyperanalyzed them, but I give I go into very long stretches in terms of revisiting them. So yeah. I'll try to go a year and a half before I go back and
to
watch the thing, just to kind of still enjoy it. Yeah. And I just feel like, and The Strangers is on that. So I think I think that's a testament to what they did in that movie. It's such a strong, creepy, it really gets under your skin.
Did Brian Bertina make the sequel or no?
No. Johannes Roberts, who did 47 Meters Down.
Hell yes. Right. And one of my top 10 from last year.
Other side of the
boy.
Door. Was the other side of the door? Was that the
Any other side of the door? Yeah.
Actually, that wasn't bad.
That was a fun film.
Was kind of surprising.
It wasn't like the greatest one, but it wasn't bad. Well, I don't think I've ever seen the ending of Strangers, the true ending, because I went to in New York. They
test screening.
I did a test screening, and I've heard that the endings changed. And then when I was at the actual press screening, like the movie's done here, Fangoria, come to the test screening. I shattered a tooth on a piece of popcorn about 20 minutes in, and left the theater in tears.
Yes. It's a very Becca thing.
Yeah, and had my tooth, what was
left of it.
So,
Becca, at the end of The Strangers, the strangers come over for tea.
They play Twister. It's fun.
It's very happy. It's a very happy, upbeat ending, let me tell you.
I heard that the ending I saw in the test screening, because I was immediately like, well, I saw the test screening, I'm fine. And then I heard that the ending is rather different. So now I have a reason to go back and watch it.
You do. And this new disc is great. And there is a pretty great new interview with Brian Bertino and new interviews with the strangers, the guy that's behind the mask and the girl. And as well as Kevin Grutert, who edited the film, and that all that new material actually made me appreciate the movie a lot more. Brian's pretty candid about it was a thing he wrote, he put it together, And it really took a lot of editing and tinkering to get it to what it was. And Kevin was a big part of that because I believe he edited that trailer. Because the studio, I think it sat on the shelf for a while, and the studio was like, we don't know about this movie. And then that trailer came out, and I was like, oh, wait, you have to edit the movie like this trailer. And so that was a big part of it. But I found a lot of that process, hearing about that process, really interesting. A lot of the stuff, not to spoil the ending, which I won't, but from the stranger's perspective, them talking about, because the final scene is really, you know, it's really something special. Kind of like the last few minutes of Blair Witch. It's like one of those things you remember.
Put my fingers in my ears and hum for a little bit.
But the way the actors talk about how they shot it and then seeing it. And I'm like, wow, that's really, really fascinating. So it's made me want to revisit the actual movie itself along, you know, before the sequel comes out. So I strongly recommend, if you don't own it at all, the Scream Factory one's the way to go.
No joke.
And on top of that, Drag Me to Hell, which I've always loved.
I love that movie so much.
And I've said a million times that I actually prefer the PG-13 theatrical. Don't watch the mean-spirited, longer director's cut. Which puts in like unnecessary violence. And you're like, oh, this isn't funny anymore. But this has a lot of great stuff. They got Alison Lohman back, and she hasn't like acted in a while. And I'm like, maybe it's because Sam Raimi like tortured her, like Bruce Campbell's. Like the story she tells about how hard this movie was.
So we're gonna dump corpse juice into your mouth. Now you sit there while you're laying down. I can't even imagine.
Yeah, it's like okay, so you're gonna open your mouth and a bucket of maggots are gonna just drop in straight out of this other woman's mouth. Go. I mean, this is the sort of stuff. And it's like, I know he does that to Bruce, but he did this poor girl. It's crazy. But anyway, she seems to be a good sport about it, and so. New interview with her, new interview with the gypsy woman, Lorna Raver, and Christopher Young, who one of my all-time favorite scores is the music he did for Drag Me to Hell. Mm-hmm. And so he's, you know, he started his relationship with Sam on Spider-Man 3, which was right before this. And so both those discs are spectacular. And if you don't own them already, you should get them. If you do, I think they are worth the upgrade, especially if you like this kind of stuff. So
nice.
Yeah, Strangers and Drag Me to Hell.
Hey, guys, you know what I've been watching a lot of?
A show that's probably going to launch a series based on your tooth breaking movie theater show.
I was
Channel Zero Presents. Becca's broken tooth
shattered
story. We got to start a story somewhere. They always find someplace.
I've been watching a lot of Butcher's Block, though.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going
to wait.
We're
not allowed to talk past episode three. I'm only three. I've watched the first three. I'm watching it in the old fashioned way. And if any creators come in here trying to fuck my shit up,
the whole thing. I have to discuss this with someone.
Hell no. No, you're not.
Becca, they all haven't aired yet, have they?
No,
guys.
No, you don't watch it that way. I like watching it episodically.
Hey, kids, you know what you don't do? Follow Elric.
Listen to me. Watch it every week.
Don't do your homework.
Watch it. No, watch it every week the way it's meant to be watched. I don't watch things on like screeners. Fuck that.
Aww. Amen. I agree with that guy.
Yeah.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Diabolik DVD. Check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. They are the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. The company is movie buff owned and operated. Are you looking for rare, unique, and strange films? Then you need to head over to Diabolik DVD. They're constantly updating their inventory and have plenty of movies that you won't find anywhere else. They revamped their website earlier this year, so ordering has never been easier. Some of their latest and upcoming titles include the new Blu-ray of Spasms from Code Red, the amazing new Blu-ray DVD combo of Disconnected from Vinegar Syndrome, the Old Boy 5-disc box set, the all-region media book release of Zetter, and the new Blu-ray of Romero's Season of the Witch from Arrow. They also have all the titles you need from Agfa, Code Red, Scorpion Releasing, Arrow Video, Vinegar Syndrome, and more. The Shockwaves team loves them, so head on over to Diabolik DVD now, www.diabolikdvd.com, or find them on Facebook.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by Shudder. Brought to you by AMC Networks, Shudder is not only a premium streaming video service, but an experience unlike any other. Created for fans of all degrees of thrillers, suspense, and horror, Shudder is home to the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of high-quality, spine-tingling, and provocative films, TV series, and originals, and there's always something new and unexpected for Shudder members to explore.
Now available on Shudder are two Dario Argento 80s classics, Tenebrae and Phenomena, now newly remastered in high definition. Widely considered one of the greatest horror directors of all time, Dario Argento has been hugely influential on the Italian thriller genre known as giallo. Shudder is proud to add two of his greatest films to its expanding library. In Tenebrae, an American author becomes embroiled in a search for a serial killer who has been inspired to kill by his new mystery novel. In Phenomena, a girl at a remote Swiss boarding school, Jennifer Connelly in an early role, discovers she has psychic powers that allow her to communicate with insects. She uses them to pursue a serial killer who is butchering young women at the school. Stream Tenebrae and Phenomena and several more Argento films on Shudder today. Shudder is available for $4.99 a month or $49.99 with an annual membership, but our listeners can get a free month by entering promo code SHOCK at checkout. Again, that's SHOCK at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of thrillers, suspense, and horror available to stream anywhere. Thank you to our sponsors. I'd like to welcome two very special guests to our show. One who has been on, I think now it's your third time, maybe
than,
second time?
More than anyone else in Shockwaves history.
Seriously.
This is third time.
This is number
third
three.
Time.
Lucky we like your show.
Yeah because because his show, Channel Zero, is celebrating its third season with the story arc Butcher's Block. I'd like to welcome Nick Antosca and director Arkasha Stevenson. Hi, guys.
Hi, guys.
Well, I just want to say, Arkasha, congratulations, because you are killing it on the show. Mm-hmm. Arkasha and I met at Sundance.
In the freezing snow.
In the freezing snow. We actually took a meeting outside on the front porch of a cafe because there was no place to sit. And you had correct me if I'm wrong, it was a backdoor pilot for Pineapple, or was it a short? Were you calling it?
We're calling it a web series. I was calling it a 30-minute piece for a while, and then my mom told me I just sounded really pretentious. I'm going to stick with web series.
Okay, yeah.
This is educational for me because I'm always, like, people are asking me, like, where did you find Arkasha? And, like, what was the thing you saw? And I'm always trying to describe Pineapple, which is, like, kind of indescribable, or you could describe it as like many, many, many different things. It's like a brilliant kind of a short film, a pilot, like. But I like default to just describing some of the things that are in it. Like, it's horrifying and it's funny and there's animation and there's like.
How'd you find it? How did you discover this piece?
I want to tell like some kind of like crazy story about like how I'm super in the know, but. I think Arkasha's agent sent it to the studio, and one of the executives at UCP, Jordana Guarino, was just a huge fan of it. Was like, you got to check out this film, like maybe for some future season, because like she hasn't done a feature. So blah, blah. And I was like, okay, I'll watch it, because I was watching like, you know, every season is like watching so many movies to try and find the director who's like perfect for the season. And I watched it and I was like, whoa, no, we gotta meet her now. She's gotta do this season. And they were like, okay. So, and then we had lunch and I basically like begged Arkasha to come and do the season. Cause you had other stuff like in the works, and I was like, please drop everything. Come direct.
Well, no. Can I tell you how I remember it? So I had never done a shoot over like 6 days or anything, and you told me like, this is going to be a 45-day shoot. This is going to be how big the crew is. And I was like, oh no, I don't think I can handle that. And this is how I remember it. You leaned and looked me straight in the eye and he said, you're going to do season 3. And I was like, oh, okay. And that was it.
Angel-hearted you. I remember pleading. I remember begging. But
going back, just between the last time you were here and now, I mean, obviously, for No End House, you know, no one knew that Butcher's Block was on the horizon. How soon, in the airing of No End House, When did you know Butcher's Block was the storyline for the third season?
Interesting question. By the time No End House aired, we had already shot Butcher's Block.
Yeah, because wow.
I did them back to back. I remember you saying
yeah.
that.
Yeah, you
like
told
that,
us yeah. like well, after the show last time that oh, you had so. Already finished the next season. And I was like, but you just were on for this season. Yeah, they
Yeah, if I seemed like kind of dazed last time I was on, it was probably because I had just come back from Winnipeg, where we'd been, you know, doing this epic crazy shoot, and we were probably deep in post or just getting into.
We were almost done editing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Holy cow!
Now, how did you select the story for this one? Because I know, like, the original one was from a creepypasta. The second one, I think, came from a creepypasta. But you guys kind of created this one,
well,
right?
Well, this one is from a No Sleep story by mm-hmm. Carrie Hammond, and it's this long, kind of wild, in-depth thing that's based on basically missing persons reports from national parks. There are these 411 missing books, which are like real reports of this stuff, and this Carrie's story is like a creepypasta version of that. It's about all these crazy, creepy, bizarre things that happen. Involving disappearances, people going missing, and in her stories, there are in national parks. And the most kind of vivid thing that everyone remembers from it is staircases that appear deep in the woods. And if you see them, you're not supposed to go near them. You know, all the kind of old timers know, like, don't go close to it, don't talk about it, whatever you do. Don't go up it, right? And just this image of the staircases in the woods and like, what is that? How did it get there? Who uses it? Does it go somewhere? Like, and it's just in this place that it shouldn't be. That always stuck with me. So we optioned that story. And then, you know, you kind of take it in the writer's room and you figure like, oh, where do we go with this? Like, how do we take the things that scared us about it and kind of... you know, sort of chase the nightmare. And this one, just in the process of, you know, working with Harley and the writer's room and wanting to do something different than we had done the first seasons, kind of evolved more than the other ones did. So there are these other, the elements of cannibalism, the decaying city, the question of what's real and what isn't, and fear of losing your mind. All of that is stuff that was like, you know, flowered up in the writer's room as we just kind of dug deep.
Mm-hmm. And at what point did you bring Arkasha into that creative process, breaking the story and so on?
So we had probably like 4 or 5 scripts done when you came in.
I had read the pilot and the second episode, I think. And
yeah, and so then and Arkasha came on with her writing partner and producing partner Tim Smith, and Arkasha and Tim came into the writer's room and we kind of exhaustively went over the episodes that we already had. And you know, every director who does Channel Zero has like a very sort of different approach to giving notes, and yours was kind of the most kind of elaborate and like
you would
be like, no it was, you know, it would be like, maybe he tap dances in this scene, and it's like that's a great idea. So you told me about sacrifice zones that came from you. I mean, what was your
initial reaction to the Butcher's Block story? What did you want to bring to it and put your own fingerprint on it?
Yeah, well, it was so interesting first reading the pilot, because at first, when I came into film, I was really interested in doing social realism and mixing that with surrealism. And I come from a journalism background, so I was interested in incorporating that into kind of the horror genre more. And so when I read Butcher's Block, it was a perfect mesh of both of those elements. And so it felt really natural to be part of that project. And then you're just so... encourages you always to bring your thoughts and feelings and ideas to it. So it was like, I think maybe I just felt really comfortable, and that's why I was like, maybe he's naked and maybe he's tap dancing and maybe this.
I love that character you're talking about. What's the character's name? The well-dressed man.
Robert P.
Brother.
He's so much fun to watch in this.
Yeah, that's kind of emblematic of like what Arkasha. Maybe he's naked on the floor, like eating the lungs.
Yeah, yeah.
and I remember when we shot that, it was like, okay, let's just like, please be like careful. Shoot one version where we can't see his ass, because the network may like make us not do that. We never got any objection.
I was going to say, has the network bucked anything that you guys have put forth? Because you guys get away with a lot of stuff in that show that's kind of questionable, which is awesome. Has there been anything that kind of raised eyebrows?
I don't remember anything. Do you?
Besides the dead mouse, no.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What's the dead mouse?
There's some...
We found a dead mouse.
On set?
On set, and got very excited about it, and we shot probably 15 minutes worth of this dead mouse, and it was like, no, we don't have...
Well, it turns out that, the filming style on Butcher's Block was very, like, there were a lot of times where you saw something and went like, oh, we gotta shoot that, that's an interesting thing, and in this case, it was like this fossilized dead mouse that had been squashed flat in this kind of crazy way.
Pancake.
It turns out to put that on TV, you need, to put any actual dead animal on TV, need a legal release saying that it died in some sort of humane way or something. So like all the taxidermy in Louise's basement, there's like a lot of legal stuff that you have to go through.
Just to show like a deer head, even if it's like 40 years old and that deer has been dead for a really long time? You have to document how it died?
I'm not sure about that, but ours we did.
That's crazy. Yeah. But were you guys, well done.
Were you Kreisha fans of the film, Kreisha? I have to assume that's how she got cast. She's one of my favorite movies that year.
Oh. Well, Nick turned me on to the movie Kreisha, and it's how long is that movie? It's about an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And it took me 4 hours to watch it because I kept pausing and being like, who is this woman?
Yeah.
I'm in love with her. And yeah.
Yeah. The role was written for her.
Yeah.
I had seen Kreisha at AFI Fest a couple years ago, and I just thought she was incredible. I mean, she's got something that almost nobody has. You know, the camera is just entranced by her. She brings a presence to it. She brings a humanity to it.
Naturalism.
She can be funny.
Yeah.
She can be, obviously Kreisha is just like naked, raw emotions.
She's dangerous in it. Like you don't know what the next move's going to be and you know it's dangerous. It's a great quality. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I loved, one of the things that I love about the show is you guys do what cannibal media rarely do, which is make the cannibals look like they actually take some time in food prep. Because usually if you're watching cannibal films, it's always more like a visceral thing. It's very animalistic. It's just, I'm going to grab your arm, I'm going to rip off a hunk and eat it raw right here. No need for a plate.
I also appreciate the usage of the Cannibal Holocaust soundtrack.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my gosh,
in the first episode, I was like, hey.
Right off the bat.
I know what that is.
But, yeah.
It's a beautiful piece of music. It's a really beautiful.
In one of the early episodes, there was, they had their main course and then they had the dessert. And both of them, I was like, that actually looks kind of tasty. I mean, it had an ear sticking out, but it was like a parfait. And then there was this one where it was like sliced meat with like arugula on top. I was like, this actually looks like I would consider.
Hannibal would appreciate it.
Yeah,
Hannibal.
It's Hannibal-ish. Good food presentation.
Yeah. I mean, Hannibal's definitely an influence. And you were pretty...
Into it, yeah.
And I was feeling Candyman as a little bit within the whole butcher mythos and the graffiti of like Rucker's weird demonic face around the urban landscape. It really had kind of a good Candyman nod.
Yeah, what were the movies that we talked, because we made a list at the beginning. Certainly Candyman. Yeah,
Candyman was on that. Fire Walk With Me was on there.
Was Vertigo on there? Because you guys have the exact recreation of the girl in green with the green light behind her shot. And I literally wanted to stop and go, oh my God, that's a recreation of the exact scene from Vertigo.
Thank you.
Yeah.
There's actually, we kind of like picked and pulled lots of little, like images. There's a Achapakpong Uncle Boo call out. Uh-huh. Yeah,
There's some Rene Magritte. I felt like you guys were channeling the artist Rene Magritte with the stairs, even with the way you isolate surrealism with naturalism. Mm-hmm. Very, this more than the other, because all the series so far have incredible nods to art. Obviously, Channel Zero definitely did, like art as in pieces of art, but there's something about this one where I think where you're talking about the journalism, it's really interesting mix between saying that looks a little more gritty and urban mixed with saying that looks totally out of place and beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really interesting design choice.
Yeah, there's a lot of architecture in this syrup, what is it, this
the dying
season
city.
Of the yeah. show. Yeah, you've got the dying city versus the opulence of the house, but then even once they start, I won't, because I'm past, I won't reveal much, but as they start going into other areas of the house, the way that the architecture mm-hmm. within there changes.
Well, in terms of the city, I mean, it was, the first season was very rural. The second season was suburban. We wanted to do a season that was urban and tell the story about a decaying city, which obviously is happening in, you know, cities all around America. And so we invented this kind of every city in middle America. And for the story where people aren't going to be missed, and they're being preyed upon. So, you know, a story about a world of predators and prey. We wanted the decay of the city to really kind of subtly echo what Alice is afraid is going to happen to her mind. And so the internal and the external kind of echoed each other. And I wrote it a little bit for Winnipeg, which, you know, it has everything. It's got beautiful parts. It's got these old kind of Chicago-like parts. It has neighborhoods that are totally run down. It has kind of woods right outside where we could do the overgrown park. It's a character in the show.
It really is. And we talked a bit about that. And Winnipeg really has so much to offer in terms of, yeah, we needed the overgrown forest. We did need this decaying town. But then we also, we needed, the park needed to be almost Jurassic because we have such a predator-prey kind of motif going on. And so I was so shocked. I was very ignorant. I went into this park and when I got to Canada, I just thought it was just going to be white, just snow. And they have these ferns I think it was just magical timing that we were shooting when these ferns were growing, but they were over my head and you just felt like a tiny animal in there. And so that was perfect for all of our wood scenes. That's exactly where you'd find a staircase, right?
Scenes where we're out there like 3 a.m. with Rutger and like in this forest of ferns and, you know, she encounters him in the woods. It's an eerie atmosphere.
Surreal. Yeah, it was like 4:00 a.m. and there's this weird light and Rutger's smoking a cigarette underneath this giant fern and you're just thinking like, yeah, I don't...
How do we end up here?
What happened? Well,
let's talk about Rutger. I mean,
yeah, how intimidating is that? It's somebody pretty new in a career of directing.
Yeah.
When you're then directing an actor like that who is, I hope he's giving, but he's a brilliant actor and I'm sure he's not always easy, but I'm very curious how you approach that.
I was petrified.
Yeah. No, I believe it. This is the tears in the rain guy.
Yeah.
One of the greatest lines in the history of all movies, you know?
He loved Arkasha. He at the end, he kind of, he took us aside and said that he had done 150 movies, and this was one of the best experiences he's ever had with a director.
Oh, that's great. How did you get to that place?
I don't know. I think me, Nick, and Rutger spent a lot of time together, and I think we all have similar ways of thinking and share a similar sense of humor and all kind of function within dream logic, kind of. Yeah. And so it definitely was, it almost was easy to start to talk to Rutger once you kind of slipped into that creative space, because he's constantly creating in his mind when he's on set, when he's off set. He would come in and just have these beautiful, brilliant ideas that really fit within the world that Nick and the writers created. And so it was kind of almost like he was the Dante to the Virgil. Which one leads who through hell? He was definitely like leading sometimes through this dream space. And so it was just a matter of keeping up with him.
This stories about him coming up with brilliant lines. It's like immediately you realize from the first time we Skyped with him, it's like, okay, this guy is going to be like a real creative contributor to the show. And his dialogue that you see in the show, I would say, I don't know what percentage, but a good amount of it is stuff that he came up with or modified enough that like it became truly his. Because an actor like that who's got this really specific, unique instrument knows what he can do. He knows what he can get away with. That like if you put some of it on the page, it just wouldn't work. You know, it's like if there's a line at dinner where he says,
I'm the real Joseph Peach, but you can call me Peachy. It's like, I would not have written that line in the script. You know, it would be, but when Rucker says it, you're like, oh, that's good, you know? I mean, he just gives you so much. There's so much great material that we couldn't even put in the show because he would give you alts and different takes. You can only use one take. We would spend, you know, we would spend hours with him just kind of like talking about stuff. He would have visual ideas. He would be like, this painting is inspiring. And, you know, with a lot of actors, you'd be like, oh my God, like, what is happening? But most of the time it was like, that's a really good idea. Like, that's...
It was great. It was at 4 a.m. We wrapped on set, and the AD came over, and he's like, Rucker's waiting for you on set. And I was like, what is he doing still up? And we have this... it was a beautiful set. And he said, couldn't you picture the painting, the nightmare here? And I was like, oh gosh, yes. And he goes, okay, good night, and walked away.
and you shot that. That's in the show.
And we shot it, yeah. And it was amazing, yeah. But there was this day when we're shooting the finale, and Nick and I were kind of by monitor and watching Rucker. And Rucker knows when it's not feeling it, when everybody else isn't feeling it, he'll just look at you and he'll go, nah, even before you call cut, nah. And he gave this performance, and like, I felt a chill through me, I think you felt a chill through you, and like, Nick and I just looked at each other and we're like, okay, we're good, we can cut. Like, we got it, and everybody knows.
Yeah.
And the other interesting thing, one of many, many, is he comes to set when he's not shooting. So like, you'll you'll be shooting and then kind of wander over the monitor. It's like, oh, hi Rucker, you know, or you like see him kind of hanging out, like, and he became good friends with the actor who plays Smart Mouth, the guy in the red costume, you know, who's obviously a homage to Don't Look Down. They became very good friends, and then Lyndon would come in on days when he wasn't shooting, the two of them would just be kind of like hanging out there, and you'd be like, wow, like in between takes, I'm like getting these, you know, kind of crazy stories and priceless stuff. And that he would incorporate stuff that he saw in other scenes, like into his own performance. You know, he's just a sponge, and kind of gives and gives it to a degree that you wouldn't expect from somebody who's done it so many times. You know, and by the way, when we thought about casting him, this was in the writer's room, and we're making a list of like legendary actors who would be like dreams to play this character, because he's like a cannibalistic patriarch. He's got to bring some gravitas. And Harley suggested Rutger Hauer, and we were all like, oh, like what's he doing? He's never going to do it. And you know, you always send out the stuff to like your dream cast, and they're always like, oh, they're busy. And we just heard like, yeah, he's read it. He likes it. He wants to Skype with you guys, and that was it. You know,
tell us about that Skype. Yeah, you know, I imagine.
Hadn't his water heater broken? And there was like, he was kind of stressed about that.
Is he LA or New York?
Oh, he's way out in Amsterdam or something.
Oh, my God.
He's from Paul Verhoeven's early career. They started their career together, Verhoeven and.
Wow, okay. Rucker, so he's still working out of there. That's awesome.
He has a farm out in Holland, yeah? And yeah, his water heater broke and sparrows were coming. They were migrating, so he like told us about the sparrows, and it was lovely.
The sparrows are flying.
Yeah.
Rutger Hauer loves birds.
Loves them.
Loves birds, and he, you know, if you know, do you remember Blade Runner?
Sure.
He's got the dove.
He's holding the dove. Yeah.
I would bet you $1 million that was Rutger's idea request. He's in Channel Zero. He's got this hat with feathers on it. Mm-hmm. That was a wardrobe choice that we came to because he had proposed having a necklace of dead birds. Was that it? And we thought it might be a little distracting.
It might have been a bit much, but exactly. So our compromise was that we put them in his hat, and he would keep feathers in his pockets. And
And there's even in that scene where he first encounters Olivia, there's a moment where an owl hoots, and he gives this great little moment. It's like, oh,
That's an owl.
Oh, yeah,
don't
yeah,
be
yeah,
afraid.
Yeah.
Like, that's him. You know, yeah, he wanted, he was like...
It's a Terrence Malick here moment. I was like, that's his Malick moment.
Does he own birds? Like, does he have a pet bird at home?
I don't know. Yeah. I'm not sure. He just really
see,
likes
it. I thought you guys cast him because there's the cannibalistic food element connection to John Ryder putting fingers in the fries. If you remember, recall in the Hitcher. When he sets up C. Thomas Howell, he puts severed fingers in the French fries. So I was like, ooh, that could be like food and cannibalism together, you know? So deep research, guys. There you go.
Deep research from Elmer Cain.
It's a happy coincidence.
let's just say that they exist all in the same universe.
Yeah, yeah.
The same character throughout. Like that was early Peach.
There's another artist when I was watching, I was curious because he's a pretty obscure photographer, but Ralph Eugene Meatyard, was that somebody you guys had seen? Because the little people, even though it's Don't Look Now, colors the faces. He made these photographs of
What's
children wearing these old man masks that are really incredible.
Well, we looked at Joel Peter Witkin a lot, and then we looked at Haunted Air.
Ossian Brown collected those photos. I don't know if they did. I think they're just like weird old photos of kids in Halloween costumes.
Yeah, yeah.
And that book has inspired something in every season of Channel Zero.
Yeah.
Like I keep it on my coffee table. It's one of my favorite like books of photography. But it most inspired Butcher's Block. And it's funny actually. After the first episode premiered, Craig McNeil texted me, who directed Candle Cove, and was like, oh, watched it. I loved it. So cool that you guys did Meatyard this time. I was like,
yeah,
who?
Yeah.
I never heard of him. But
yeah, he's probably referencing that book. Meatyard, the photographer, probably was influenced by that book.
Maybe. But do we look at Arthur Tress also, maybe? Those creepy photos of kids. Anyway, we looked at a million things.
A lot of creepy kids.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about the effects? Because the creepy kid beings in the movie, they've got these crazy faces and they're all a little bit different. Could you talk a little bit about the effect and the actual application of those?
Yeah. So those were prosthetics and a mask, and Lyndon, who plays Smart Mouth, had and dentures, just so that he could move his face a lot because he's such an important character and he can speak. But the other children have masks that actually strangely look somewhat like if in a parallel universe they were homunculus children.
Yes.
It was very disturbing seeing those masks and working with those children. But they're very heavy. And those kids were such troopers. They would wear these very heavy masks and dance and run around.
I was a little nervous about, like, are their parents going to be, like, cool, you know? But everybody was thrilled. I mean, they had
a
good time.
Yeah.
and to go right out of the gate for episode one, within the first 10 minutes, to terrify you with one of those guys. I was just like, oh, my God, nightmare.
Yeah, I think shooting that stuff on the day of Smart Mouth with the mask coming at him, like it was like the sun was coming up and there was that mist over the ground, and it was one of the few times where like you feel the suspense in the monitor without having to do any editing.
It was like it felt a little electric, you know, when something magical happens that wasn't planned. And it was, we had been doing these overnights in this park, and like it's a beautiful park and it was a wonderful shoot, but you get really tired and there are mosquitoes the size of children out there that are hunting you. And so it was probably our last hour out, and the sun started to come out, and it was like this velvety gray, and there's this thick blanket of mist, and everybody was just kind of like, we have to shoot right now. And it was so eerie. And then with Smart Mouth in the middle of it, it was this very unplanned creepy thing that just happened.
You really put the creepiness of Winnipeg and its surrounding environment to like great use. I mean, the fields that I don't know when this podcast will be airing, but as we're recording it, episode 4 is airing on TV.
Yeah.
And the yellow canola fields, which appear for a week in Canada, Arkasha was the first to shoot them for our show.
So wait, those were actually there? Oh my gosh. There's, well, in the show, there's these fields of flowers, and it's just so vast and such a saturated color that you just assume that you guys did that in post or did something cool with it.
Well, I mean, you touch up the color.
Yeah. But no,
it was all there for use.
Yeah, it's breathtaking.
What are those plants?
It's they're canola flowers.
Like where the oil comes from?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's for like 2 weeks or something, you know. So we'd be scouting on previous seasons and be like driving past these unbelievable endless yellow fields. I was like, holy shit. And then when Akasha was up there scouting, I guess they told you it was going to be like that and showed you pictures, or
they were the farmers showed us pictures, and it's beautiful, but you have no idea how it's going to affect you when everything's in full bloom. But they're only the right bloom for, it was less than, I think it was less than a week.
Yeah,
that those flowers are going to be in perfect shape, and so we planned around the bloom. So we needed to be there between July 20th and 23rd, no matter what, and scheduled around that. And it was worth it because you go there and you just feel like you're in a Rothko painting. It was so surreal.
And our budget is so low that we have to rely on, you know, just finding cool stuff like that. And I feel like in terms of doing it, like, this season and what Akasha did with the locations there just is, I was like, holy shit.
Yeah. Akasha, you had mentioned the kind of daunting task of taking on the schedule, the shooting schedule. You know, at what point, you know, in the, how many days in did you go, oh no, this is going to be a breeze. I'm going to take this on. Never.
No. But it was harder than I expected and easier than I expected.
Yeah.
It was easier just because, I mean, Nick, you were so supportive and you were there every day, kind of keeping up the morale. But you do go through these like waves of mm-hmm. insanity.
Yeah.
Where you're just like, this is great, we're fine. And then you're just, oh,
and then everything's on fire.
Yeah, then everything's on fire. But it was, like, the crew in Winnipeg is so amazing that you just become an army together and you trudge through. So, yeah. And there's always something crazy that you're shooting that day. So you forget that you're actually working. That's great. Yeah.
For Nick, I mean, like, is it a family environment now? I mean, like, three seasons in, are you using the same crew or?
Pretty much. You know, people come in and out, they get other jobs here and there, but I would say it's like 70 to 90% the same crew to season behind the camera, other than director and, you know, one or two others. So, we have a great crew up there who. They're just like a crack team of professionals who it's like there's maybe like one or two kind of crews deep in Winnipeg. And so you're always fighting to get the people who are like awesome.
Yeah.
I've just been like incredibly proud of what, you know, they've been able to do. As on the first day of the first season, you kind of you have a big meeting and I sort of said to everybody, like, okay, we're just going to think about this. Don't think about, like, shooting a TV show. Just imagine we're shooting an indie movie. Don't think about coverage in the traditional way you would. We're going to be doing something different every day, and we're going to be doing something radically different every season. And so now we're able to start fresh every season creatively, but everybody knows what the kind of guiding principles and aesthetics are. And it's been really nice to see that. And right now we're just starting to prep the fourth installment, and I can see it kind of coming together again. I just landed coming back from Winnipeg yesterday. Everyone misses you.
Oh, good. Yeah. I'm a little jealous. I miss everyone.
Well, what do you have going on next, Akasha?
I'm working in the horror genre still. Mm-hmm. I'm in love with it. So, am I allowed?
Oh, you know what? No. I answered my own question.
Bad Turk move.
Oh, shit.
She's got a secret project.
TV continues.
Splice.
Ryan, wow, sometimes it's really tough to be a host and be on the other side of the, just, you know, the projects. Well, guys, thank you very much for coming on.
Yes.
This season is, you know, is phenomenal and terrifying, and it really gets under your skin, and this is really great.
And so, get the word out, because I yeah, honestly seriously. Believe and I don't know if it's because it's on Sci-Fi or where it is, but and you never know. Maybe it's because there's still this idea it's TV, because it's just not TV, in my opinion. It's just, in the same way Twin Peaks wasn't TV.
It doesn't
It's episodic, sure, but it's not what we think of as television.
It's a shorter run.
I really
run, it's
want the
connected.
Show to get on Netflix or Hulu or Shudder or Amazon or one of the. I don't know. I don't know. There's a huge corporate entity there that does that stuff.
But let's also drive some eyeballs to the show. Like, seriously, this season I'm really invested. I'm three episodes and I'm just totally taken by the artistry. You're creating something really special.
And keep an eye out. I mean, like, just this is to our listeners out there. You know, a couple weeks ago, and I don't know if it still stands, but Candle Cove was like $5 on iTunes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So it's just like,
oh, yeah, they had a thing.
They had a thing, you know. So
is there a physical release of that? I think overseas.
Yeah.
They've only put they're out on DVD here, but like not even Blu-ray.
What?
Yeah.
So
what?
The best way to watch them in terms of picture quality and seamless cuts and everything is get them on iTunes. I mean, I want everybody to watch them when they air on Sci-Fi. So
yes, of course.
If you want to watch them again or if you miss them, then iTunes is probably the best place at the moment.
Well, that's the thing, man. I mean, like, you guys have created a show that is worth watching again. You know, I mean, like, and seeing, you know, Candle Cove, I'm ready to dig back in again and just kind of binge it and watch it as a film almost.
And I know I have Roku, and there's a Sci-Fi app with Roku, and you can watch the old episodes on that. So, or at least the ones from this season, at least. But I feel like No End House is on there as well.
Yeah. At various times, they all have been. I haven't looked recently, but Sci-Fi app, you can watch them.
Yeah.
Are you still making multiple seasons at a time, like in terms of the close together, or do you think it's going to slow down a bit?
You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, and we have one more season that's ordered.
Yeah. After the main one? Or
No, after the fourth installment that's coming up.
Okay.
The fourth installment that's coming up is the one that's...
Yeah.
And after that, you know, we just find out if we get renewed or not. Yeah. I have really cool ideas for at least two more installments.
Cool.
The ratings aren't great, so I wouldn't be surprised either way. But we have a dedicated fan base, and, they're very proud of the show at Sci-Fi.
Yeah.
So... I'm ready to go if they want to make more.
Yeah. Oh, shit,
so
man.
Support the hell Horror out fans. Of Candle
Come
Cove
on.
And
we'll keep waving the banner.
Channel Zero and keep waving the banner.
Right. Come on, you Magritte fans.
Yeah, where are the Magritte fans?
These French Belgium surrealist fans.
I just Googled that while y'all were talking because I was like, I don't
know
who
that is. I watched Becca try to just navigate her way through that, that Google search.
I did. I was very much
that's
like,
a small victory for the day.
Nick, Akasha, thanks again for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Of course.